Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Executive Vice President and CEO Emeritus of the American College of Physicians, Dr. Steven Weinberger, about whether physicians should be required to periodically renew their certifications. He'll have a very good perspectives on this and looking forward to this conversation. First, let's talk about some research that matters. Our very first research that matters is actually a study about if anyone has ever had a preterm baby. When you go to the nursery where the preterm babies go after they deliver, they're usually in these very large rooms with all these other preterm babies. And it feels oftentimes like we might think of a ward, and we think about these facilities as necessary because these kids are very sick often. They have infections. The doctors are there, and they can kind of rush and be there. The question, however, comes up, are these kind of open wards, are they better than what they could be designed to be single-family rooms, kind of like you see for adults? So the question for these preterm babies is, do the babies do better, both physically and cognitively, perhaps if they're in single rooms? And this is research that was published in the Lancet Child and Adolescent Health Journal. They did what we call a systematic review, where they put all the studies together to look at outcomes. And these are really young babies. They were less than 28 weeks gestation, a 40-week normal gestation for a child. And one of the things they were particularly interested in was something called sepsis. These are the serious infections, the whole body infections that can really affect and kill a child who is really at risk for these sorts of infections. And then they wanted to see, what about breastfeeding, the bonding that could occur between a mother and a child that may be more difficult in these larger rooms? And then what about neurocognitive? So these children, as they develop, could there be issues relating to how these children develop? And they had 13 studies that they looked at, over almost 4,500 as preterm babies. And they looked at the long-term, up to 24 months, cognitive motor language development, and really wanted to understand, is there any difference? And what they found, which I found really important, is that the risk of sepsis, this serious infection that can be fatal in these single-family rooms, was significantly less, 37% less than those that were in these open bay units. That's one less sepsis infection event per 1,000 hospitalization days. They also found significant improvements in breastfeeding, so that those who were in the single family rooms were 31% more likely to be exclusively breastfed. There were no differences in hospital stay and a lot of other infections, no differences in mortality, and no difference in the cognitive issues, but they were not able to follow them past the 2 years, and there's not a whole lot of kids that had those sorts of outcomes assessed. Well, what should we do? It's very expensive to change all these open bays into these single rooms. You have to have these monitoring equipment. You'd have to have maybe more staffing. On the other hand, you would cut down on infections and have more mother bonding with the child potentially. I think the answer is perhaps there should be choices here. Our next research that matter is probably more straightforward, and it really is has to do with the children once they're born and they're now growing. What do we do about their screen time? How much time do we have them in front of things like iPads or TVs or computers, telephones, smartphones? And in general, we recommend children less than two that they really don't have this time in front of these devices. And this study in the journal BMC Obesity looked at the parenting practices and the time that they allow their young children to spend in front of screens. And it was 62 children between 18 months and 5 years of age and 68 parents. This was actually up in Canada, and they found that children spend about, of these younger children even, they spent nearly an hour and a half in front of a screen during weekdays and 2 hours a day on weekends. parents spend 2 hours a day on average during the week and over 2.5 hours a day on weekends. And if you looked at what influenced a children's use of the screen time, it was influenced – one of the factors was whether or not the parents used the screen time as a reward. Yes, you heard me, as a reward. And a majority of the parents said that they use it as a way to control behavior, especially on weekends. If you eat all of your dinner, you could have an extra 30 minutes watching that TV show. And this resulted in children spending an average of 20 minutes more a day on the weekend in front of a screen. This is, I think, pretty worrisome. I think it's also a suggestion that perhaps we should not be using screen time as an incentive, because we want to cut down on the screen time, particularly for these young children. We also don't want them watching screen time when they're eating meals, and this was also seen in the study. Important study. We'll have our great friends, the health sciences librarians, put this up on the website for others to take a look at. Our next research that matters is pretty straightforward. It's about alcohol consumption and atrial fibrillation. That's when that heart has that abnormal beating. This was actually published in the journal Heart Rhythm, appropriately. And it looked at 75 patients with atrial fibrillation, and they looked at them in three different categories: those who were lifelong non-drinkers, those who were mild drinkers, and those who were moderate drinkers. The moderate drinkers drank on average 14 drinks per week. That seems like actually a lot to me, but that was considered moderate. And they found that those who consumed moderate amounts of alcohol had much more electrical evidence of scarring and electrical signaling than non-drinkers and light drinkers. This confirms actually data that is seen in some of the systematic reviews that show an 8% increase in atrial fibrillation for each additional daily standard drink. Certainly, being at risk for atrial fibrillation, we control the blood pressure, we don't smoke, we do the things we can do with exercise. Probably we should be doing more with alcohol consumption and limiting our alcohol consumption. Last research that matters is a study of chronic fatigue syndrome. I bet all our listeners have heard of this, and many may think, I wonder if it's real. And if they have chronic fatigue, they may think, you know what, many doctors don't really give this the weight it deserves, and they make me feel if it's not real. Well, it is a real syndrome. There are diagnostic criteria by established medical authorities, and what they wanted to find out is, do people with chronic fatigue avoid going to the emergency room because they think perhaps doctors don't treat them as if the disease is real? And what they found actually corroborated that. 282 people, this was published in the journal Open Access Emergency Medicine, and they found that only 60% of the patients had gone to the emergency department, and almost half of those patients who had were dismissed as having what we call psychosomatic complaint. And so it kind of confirmed that if you went to the emergency room and you had chronic fatigue, it may be perceived as not a real. 41% did not go to the emergency department because when they felt ill, they felt they wouldn't be taken seriously. I think the simple factor is that if you have chronic fatigue and you need to go to the emergency room, you should go to the emergency room and tell the doctor, this is real. Do you believe me? And have an open and honest conversation. As the doctors, we need to do a much better job of conveying, you are welcome here. We believe your symptoms and we want to help. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with the Executive Vice President and CEO Emeritus of the American College of Physicians, Dr. Steven Weinberger, about whether physicians should be required to periodically renew their certifications. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Executive Vice President and CEO Emeritus of the American College of Physicians, Dr. Steven Weinberger, about whether physicians should be required to periodically renew their certifications, a really critical, important, and sometimes controversial issue for which we're really excited to have Dr. Weinberger here. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Weinberger.
Thank you, Adam. Good to be here.
You've had a really interesting career in academia and as CEO of one of the largest, if not the largest, healthcare physician organization in the United States. And I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit, how did you get interested in medicine? And did you think you would be doing what you have done and are doing?
Well, I have to say it's always interesting to look back on one's career that way. I think I probably wanted to be a physician from early on, but I don't think I ever would have ended up doing what I actually did do. I was interested after training in academic medicine and, in fact, had my career evolve largely in medical education. I'm a pulmonary and critical care physician, but ended up doing a lot of work in medical education, had been on the faculty at Harvard Medical School for many years. And then in 2004, a position became available to be senior vice president for medical education at the American College of Physicians. And I thought it would be interesting to be doing medical education at a national level. So I ended up taking that position. And then in 2010, 6 years after I had been in the position of senior vice president, the CEO of ACP retired, and I ended up being chosen as the CEO, which was interesting because it ended up allowing me to sort of expand my horizons from medical education to broader aspects of healthcare policy, healthcare delivery, a lot of things that I really had not been exposed to in the past, but fortunately ACP has a terrific staff and they were able to guide me through a lot of those things.
You know, I know when you were the CEO of the American College of Physicians, you talked about really dramatic changes that you and the college championed around patient care, policy, and advocacy. I wonder if you could give us maybe one example in each of those domains. Maybe we'll start with patient care. What's been a fundamental change that you and the college have really helped shepherd and are passionate about?
Well, one thing I'm passionate about is the whole area of partnership with patients, not only in their own care, but also in the way that we deliver care as a healthcare system. So back in 2013, I established what we ended up calling the Center for Patient Partnership in healthcare at ACP. And the idea behind that was to instill a culture among our physicians that care really needed to incorporate the values, goals, and preferences of the patient. That needed to be at the forefront of what we did, in addition, obviously, to providing the clinical and scientific components of medicine. But also that we really needed to listen to the patient's voice about how we delivered care and how we could make the healthcare system better. On the policy side, I think that there were really two main areas that were of interest to me, or at least I'll give you two examples. One was the whole area of firearms violence, and we ended up working with a number of the other medical professional organizations to write a number of papers talking about how firearms violence is a public health problem that we as healthcare professionals absolutely feel need to be addressed with a variety of what we think are sensible regulations about firearms. The other area that was very important, and we got involved in this a number of years ago, was the whole area of costs of care and how it was critical for the medical profession to embrace a culture of high-value, cost-conscious care. So we started a high-value, cost-conscious care initiative, developed curricula, actually went out on a lot of speaking engagements to physicians around the country about this, specifically about avoiding overuse and misuse of care that was unnecessary or did not benefit patients.
And then what about in advocacy? Would the firearms, because it's impossible to only probably talk about research if one is not willing to advocate for policies to improve those poor outcomes.
Oh, absolutely. No, the whole issue of firearms violence became a very important advocacy issue at ACP, and in fact still is very much, even after the time that I retired as CEO, that has very much continued as one of the most important policy areas. The other policy area, which actually really started well before me, but continued, was the whole area of universal access to care, and that included support for the Affordable Care Act, which was certainly very important both during the time that I was there and has continued to be the case.
Let me ask you one other question relating to patient care before we'll begin to transition to talk about the certification, your recent essay. You've talked about this high-value care. You've talked about the partnership in healthcare and the changing patient expectations of healthcare to get care when they want it, where they want it, and yet this need to maintain the longitudinal relationship. How do you maintain that longitudinal relationship at a time in which patients may expect care in minute care settings or expect it to be delivered over the phone? How do you think that occurs? What do you see the new paradigm?
That's a wonderful question. And I think a lot of that really depends upon our thinking creatively about how we redesign our practices as teams, in groups, in ways so that we are able to provide that type of coverage of patients when the patients want it and when the patients need it. There are a variety of ways to do this, probably more detail than we want to get into as far as examples, but there are many practices that have been able to redesign the way that they deliver care through innovative coverage modalities, through better use of team-based care, not only from physicians, but also using nurse practitioners, physician assistants, et cetera, so that care can be provided to patients when and where they want. The whole area of telephone access or online access, I think, is also something that's very important. And I think that practices have been really, in many cases, trying to expand that type of opportunity for patients, which helps not only patients, but I think helps the practice as well.
I know one thing that you are passionate about in the colleges and really most professional organizations should be is understanding physician burnout, because as you describe these changing natures and the challenges of the electronic medical records and the increasing time spent behind a computer rather than in front of patients, we know the burnout. Tell us just what's the main concern and what do you think is being done to address it? Because then I know your essay really touches on this.
Sure. Well, physician burnout is obviously a very important issue right now. First of all, let's talk a little bit about what is responsible for it. A lot of people focus on things such as the electronic health record and how in many cases it ends up taking up more time for patients. I think along with the electronic health record, a very important issue is the documentation requirements, which have become very burdensome. And some of the complaints about the EHR actually are really complaints about the amount of documentation that one needs to be putting into the EHR. Obviously, things such as paperwork with pre-authorization, burnout because of productivity pressure and the decreasing amount of time that people have to spend with patients. All of these things contribute. There's not one single thing. And of course, there are many physicians who complain about the maintenance of certification process, which we'll also get into. One of the big questions is how we approach this issue. And people often talk about physician resilience. To me, I think that's not quite the right way to approach the treatment for physician burnout. The problem is, how do you actually get rid of the underlying causes for physician burnout? And I think a lot of that is addressing the regulatory kinds of requirements that physicians are subjected to, whether it's billing, documentation requirements, pre-authorization, et cetera. It's certainly very complicated and will be a long process to address these issues, but I think it can be done, and certainly that those are some of the things that ACP has been advocating for. And finally, I think that redesigning how electronic health records are, making them more friendly to the physician so that they do not take as much time to spend using them would be very important. Many people feel that these records were designed actually more by people who were not physicians, and they were designed more for the billing system than for communication about patients and from physicians to other physicians or other healthcare providers. So it's a very complicated issue, but certainly it's one at the forefront, I think, of many organizations' advocacy efforts right now, and certainly after has continued with my successor as the CEO of ACP. I know it's one of her very high priorities.
Well, we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're actually going to continue this conversation about one of the issues around physicians and ensuring continuing competency, but maybe also linked to physician burnout, which is this maintenance of certification. We're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Steven Weinberger after we take a short break. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Executive Vice President and CEO of Emeritus of the American College of Physicians, Dr. Steven Weinberger, about physicians and a broad-based conversation of the work that he and the American College of Physicians really shepherded around patient care and policy and advocacy. And we were just finishing up a conversation really about some of the stresses and challenges of burnout. And here comes along a wonderful essay you just wrote, Dr. Weinberger, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association about maintenance of certification. Help us understand what that is and why that's relevant to both patients and providers.
Well, the whole issue of maintenance of certification started when there was a change in the philosophy of some of the medical boards and the American Board of Medical Specialties. Whereas certification used to be something that was lifelong, there was concern that physicians might be either losing their skills or might not be keeping up with what is happening in medicine, and that the initial certification that one gets after residency and fellowship training, that should not be lifelong, but rather physicians should be held to documenting their competence over the course of their professional career. And that was really the start of maintenance of certification. And it went through a number of different iterations in terms of how it would look, and certainly varied to some extent from specialty to specialty. Interestingly, the American Board of Family Practice did not have lifelong certification. So when they first started, I think it was back in 1969 or so, something like that, their certification only was for a limited period of time, approximately 7 years or so. So what the other boards decided to do over a period of time was also to institute this idea of maintenance of certification. And certainly one of the big components of that was an examination that needed to be taken at specified intervals depending upon the particular board. Other components were then added on, and one of the ones that I think became particularly important for many of the boards was a demonstration of practice quality and practice improvement. And those things ended up leading to a fair amount of concern and complaints from individual physicians, specifically about the examination. And we can talk about what some of the issues are with that, as well as concern about how one documents quality and whether some of the requirements really truly demonstrate that a physician practices high quality medicine.
You know, as a family physician, I knew from the outset that I was expected to have to undergo this examination. It's 7 years. I've had it 3 or 4 times in my career. And I was a little bit peeved initially that the other specialties weren't all there, but they're all there now. And I actually was peeved also about the cost of these tests. They're very expensive. You have to take time off. You have to study. And it seemed to me if I was studying all the time and practicing all the time, certainly I was up to date. Is that the philosophy today, so that the tests aren't really designed to test my base of knowledge, but to test if I'm up to date?
I think it's a combination. The idea behind it is to assure that physicians have maintained whatever knowledge they've had and maintain whatever skills they've had, but in addition that they've kept up with obviously a discipline that changes on a very rapid basis. You know, it's interesting when you bring up the thought about how you as a family physician always expected that you had to be maintaining your certification, and concern that there were other specialties that had lifetime certification. Well, if you look at the other specialties besides family medicine, One of the things that has irked many physicians is that there has often been a two-tier system, because people who had received their certification before a certain period of time were considered to be grandfathered, and they had lifelong certification, whereas people who had their certification often after approximately 1990 or so would have to recertify. So there was a two-tier system where the younger physicians were rather peeved that the older physicians did not have to go through it. However, the boards have put sort of more and more pressure on the older physicians, even ones with lifetime certification, to be going through maintenance certification, although they cannot actually take initial certification away from them.
And I know that you talk in your article, you talk about not just the examination, you talk about this idea of doing quality improvement. And those of us who are in medicine, we kind of know what that means, but for this maintenance of certification, if you're a busy physician in practice, many of them have rebelled against this kind of requirement. They have to do a quality improvement project, even though there are many ways of achieving that. How have you navigated and believe that space is being navigated? Does that help ensure that those physicians are better physicians?
Well, personally, I have my concerns about the way it's been implemented. I mean, certainly one of the problems early on was that for physicians to be fulfilling this requirement, they would have to often go back into charts, pull a certain number of charts of patients that had a particular diagnosis, for example, then look at certain aspects of their care, often a number of aspects of their care that would have to be documented. Then they would have to develop a quality improvement program to improve the way that they were delivering care in those areas and show that the outcomes had changed, and essentially do a remeasurement a number of months afterwards. This was viewed very much as busy work, and there were a number of problems with it. I mean, one is that your ability to provide good quality care in one area, let's say treatment of hypertension, does not necessarily at all reflect your ability in other areas. So it may either be better or worse than in other areas. Another thing I think that's very important, and this is particularly true for those physicians who are in disciplines where diagnostic ability is so important, none of these quality improvement projects or requirements for documenting quality of care could really measure diagnostic capability. So what would happen is you would take a patient, you'd say that a patient had hypertension or whatever, but in no way was it measuring your ability to make a diagnosis of, let's say, a complicated infectious disease or a complicated multi-system disease or anything like that. It was using patients who already had a particular diagnosis. The other very important issue is that now medicine is often delivered to patients in a team-based fashion, and also patients will often have more than one physician following them. And how can you attribute quality to a particular physician when several physicians or several healthcare providers are involved? So this whole issue of attribution became a very important and difficult one. And finally, many people were saying that now healthcare insurers are often requiring data about the quality of care that's provided, and isn't it just a duplication of that effort to have to provide it to the boards? So some of the boards were saying that you could actually submit that data and you wouldn't have to duplicate it, but that still does not change the other issues that I mentioned about attribution, diagnostic ability, et cetera.
You know, one of the things, and I think you've laid out really nicely the kind of challenges, and for our listeners who are not physicians, the great and overwhelming majority, helping them understand kind of inside the physician world. But one of the things you talk about is that the goal here is to kind of close any gaps in knowledge in a learning process that's lifelong, and how to kind of ensure that. It reminds me of like when we think about doing an evaluation, that it's not about saying, are you doing a good job or not? It's how to help you do your job better. Where do you think we might need to go that really has that mind and goal, which I know you write about in your essay and which we'll share with our listeners, is so key and critical?
Right. I think you've put your finger on it. The important thing as physicians go through a career is not really to keep testing them. in a high-stakes way, where the idea is you either keep your certification or lose your certification. The more important thing is for physicians to be able to know what are their areas of weakness or deficiency or areas where they have not kept up. And what we need to do is to have physicians identify those areas. And it's often very difficult for physicians to self-identify, so that an external entity such as a medical professional organization or a board can help to identify those areas. But then what you need to do is be providing educational material for the physicians so that they can close those gaps in their knowledge. That is what improves patient care. And I think that the whole purpose of maintenance of certification should be to make physicians better doctors and to make the care that they provide to their patients better than it has been. And the way that you do that is by finding out those areas that are gaps and having ways to rectify those gaps.
Helping me understand to know what I don't know.
That's exactly right. And I think one thing that everyone recognizes is that it's very hard for us to identify those areas ourselves. We need to have some external setting of those topics that are important for us in what is called a formative way to help us identify what those areas are. And by formative, what I mean is an approach that allows physicians to get feedback so that they can then improve upon those areas that are gaps.
So it may be less important that I know that there's a fourth different drug to treat the same disease that hasn't improved dramatically over the first one I learned, but maybe I should know that there's new research out that shows that these patients shouldn't be on a drug like aspirin, that maybe I had them all on for a decade.
That's absolutely right. And the other issue that is important is nowadays physicians often depend upon electronic media to get information. We cannot remember everything off the top of our head. And I think it really is the good physician who is able to understand what he or she does not know and is able to then either find the information or learn about those areas. We cannot expect a physician to know everything, have everything stored in his or her brain.
Well, we certainly want to thank you for sharing what was in your brain with the Journal of the American Medical Association and translating that to your health listeners. We want to thank you for being our guest, Dr. Steven Weinberger.
Thank you very much, Adam. Good to talk with you.
We've been talking to Dr. Steven Weinberger, CEO, Emeritus of the American College of Physicians, about physicians and policy and healthcare and advocacy. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And if anyone has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question about something from the past, present, and hopefully future.
So our first question is, I recently fell and had a bad bruise and cut on my leg. I went to see the doctor who told me I needed to rest, keep my leg elevated, and change the bandage twice daily. He also wanted to see me back twice a week for several weeks to make sure that it didn't get infected. I told him this would be hard because I'm in my 80s, I live alone, and I don't really drive much. He then did something that kind of shocked me. He said he would do a home visit instead. I didn't know doctors still did those, and what a blessing.
Wow, what a great thing to share, huh?
Yeah, that's nice.
You know, it's interesting. Laura, you're not old enough to remember the what we call the house calls. We have a section of this show. It's actually called House Calls. Based on history and this idea that sometimes it works better to actually see the patient in their home than in the office. It's kind of a radical concept, isn't it?
It seems to be today anyway. I'm sure it wasn't when
Well, you know, it's how I was trained as a family physician. It's how my mentors trained me and how we train those that have followed us. We recommend that they actually continue to do that. You know, one visit to a person's home, you learn so much more. You get to get up and around and look at the pictures on the walls, look at their books, understand where their pills are, how the pills are laid out. It's worth so much more. I think it's worth more to the provider than even to the patient.
More context about their health in general, just the way they live and who they are.
Yeah. In addition to which, you're not hurried as much, right?
Right.
In this particular setting, you could probably see how well the person's moving around their place. Are there obstacles there, slip rugs, places that are steps where this elderly person might be at risk of falls? These are things you're not going to easily get when they come into your office because, you know, you're – well, maybe they'll get up on the exam table. I probably really enjoy being able to do this. Now, it is a little more difficult. You got to get good lights. You may have to have gloves there. You know, you have to make sure you got your little black bag, you know, so to speak, or your knapsack in the modern way. But, well, thank you for that listener observation. And here's to doctors really making calls to patients at home that need it. What's our very next house call?
I'm a really healthy person who's been on no medications virtually my whole life. I have slightly elevated cholesterol and perhaps don't exercise quite as much as I should, but I am 75 years old and I have no chronic health problems. At a recent doctor's visit, he told me I would probably need to start a statin because of my age and elevated risk. My lipid test came back and said that my risk was 25%, meaning that I had a 1 in 4 chance of a heart attack or stroke in the next 10 years. He recommended I start a moderate dose statin. Is this reasonable?
Yeah, it is reasonable. And the reality is we think we are healthy and we may not be able to feel better than that. But how we stay in that pattern, it's hard to say. And this this calculator takes into account your age and your gender and whether or not you smoke or have high blood pressure, whether your ethnicity. And it then looks at things like diabetes as well as your blood pressure and then your cholesterol, your HDL and your total cholesterol. And it gives you a calculation. In this particular case, it's 25%. And we say if it's more than 10%, that's a risk that probably you would benefit. 25%, that's a pretty good risk.
Yeah.
You're healthy. You're likely to have a good long life expectancy. But, you know, we do know the number one cause of death is heart attacks, and number two is right up there in strokes and cancer. So we could really lower that risk. Now, the side effects of statins, you might have muscle aches, and we take that into account. But it is a minority of people who have that. And if you have it, you probably wouldn't take it. It might not be the right medicine for you. I think it's reasonable. I think you should talk with your doctor. You probably would do well. What's our very last house call?
We're trying to decide for our mother whether or not she needs to have an aide at her house, go into an assisted living center, or go into a long-term care facility, and when we might need to make these choices. How do you as a doctor advise patients and families in your practice?
The short answer is, well, you already know that something needs to be done. You're asking the question. You're worried. You're concerned, whether it's memory or physical health or other things. Independence may be threatened. You may feel that they maybe need someone at night because they've had some falls. Maybe they need help with bathing, help with eating, help with shopping. Ah, that's a home care aide. Maybe their medications are too complicated. That may be an assisted living. Maybe they're having memory issues, and that may be a memory unit and in more of a nursing environment. All these questions are great ones. It's not simple. I love continuing care communities where you can start an independent living and then move into assisted living and go into the nursing or memory when you need it. But they're expensive. Not everyone can afford those. So I think it really depends. We're willing to work and listen to patients and their families, and that's what we probably need to do because sometimes we have to figure out and be creative with the different financial models that are available.
Right.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us on Your Health. You can share anything you want with us by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Steven Weinberger. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.